From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past March on the shores of Lake Ontario, where homeowners faced the highest water levels in 100 years of record keeping. The flooding caused millions of dollars of damages to homes and businesses, not to mention major environmental effects. So in light of that, perhaps it seems unusual to talk about water preservation. And some people might say, we've got more water than we know what to do with. Don't we have clean water? Well, let's turn to the science. Excessive water volume, especially related to weather events, is considered a form of pollution. Runoff can enter creeks, rivers, and lakes, compromising water quality, hurting wildlife, and leading to economic consequences for communities. And now is a good time to talk about preserving our water, keeping it clean, our water bodies. And this hour, we're talking to the team behind the H2O Hero program. They're celebrating 10 years of educating the community about how to protect our lakes and rivers. We'll discuss the initiative's progress and if its goals have changed because of weather events in our community. And our guests will help us understand the science and the mission and what we can do as consumers. So let me go ahead and say hello to the people at the table. And they start with Todd Butler, the president and CEO of Causewave Community Partners. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Evan.
Caroline Kilmer is a WBE certified stormwater consultant and chair of the Water Education Collaborative. Caroline, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
Paul Swyko is a coordinator for the Water Education Collaborative. Paul, welcome to you.
Glad to be here, Evan.
And Dan Manili is president and chief science officer for the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Dan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I was saying to our guests right before the hour began, there's so much here, and I'm kind of feeling a little overwhelmed, not just on the science, but on making sure I understand what the mission is. And Todd, you know, you said that in the 10 years of an H2O Hero program, there's been maybe a little bit of a shift. Is it more about what the consumers can do? What do you want the community to be focused on here?
Well, I think that awareness of the fact that the real main issues around water pollution today are things that aren't out of our control. It's not big industry. In terms of water quality pollution that happens in our community, it's really coming from consumers' front and backyards. And so for the last 10 years, we've really been focused on sharing that word with people. And we certainly have changed our tack in recent years, and be happy to talk some more about how we've changed that. But really, there is a role that every single citizen can play in having a positive influence over water quality in our community.
And so let me compare this to climate change in this way. When we talk about climate, a lot of people say, well, what can I do? And we talk about what is your gas mileage for your car? What kind of light bulbs are you using? And then we hear people get frustrated and say, that's not enough. You know, there has to be societal change, has to be really big, has to be at the macro level, and I'm feeling sort of dwarfed by that. Fair or not. On the water pollution level, you seem to be saying, you can't just point to big industry. You can't just say, well, it's their thing. It is our front and backyards. It is our community. It is our own habits, yes?
Absolutely. And I think one of the sayings I was reflecting on and getting ready to talk to you today was that, you know, the saying we hear all the time about think globally and act locally. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true and it applies to water quality, but you can also think locally and act locally when it comes to water quality, because what you do in your front yard has an influence over the nearest body of water, which is connected through this huge plumbing system that some of it man-made, some of it not, that connects every water body essentially in our community to the Genesee River, Lake Ontario, Ronicoit Bay.
All right. And Caroline Kilmer is a WBE certified stormwater consultant and chair of the Water Education Collaborative. When we look at what causes pollution, I mean, I think some people might say, hey, this is not the part of the country that has to worry about clean water. Don't we have this wonderful resource? Aren't we in good position compared to the others? Why are we focused on this? How do you answer that question?
Well, we do have an abundance of fresh water here, which is a great asset to this area. But a lot of people don't realize that 80% of the pollution problems in Lake Ontario are the result of wrong stuff going down neighborhood storm drains. So the storm drain that you see in front of your house, near your driveway, in your parking lot, things that go down that drain don't end up going, going to the water treatment facility. They end up going to our nearby creeks and streams. And that water doesn't get treated before it gets discharged.
And so what are the biggest culprits in your eyes, the low-hanging fruit that we can access and start making change with?
Well, there's fertilizer is an important component.
Should we not be fertilizing our lawns?
Well, certainly no fertilizer would be a good thing. However, recently the New York State passed a law requiring stores to offer phosphorus-free fertilizer, because most soils here in this area are abundant with phosphorus and they don't actually need phosphorus. So using phosphorus-free fertilizer, making sure that you're following the instructions on the fertilizer and not adding too much fertilizer, making sure that you're fertilizing in the fall as opposed to the spring when there's less rain, and sweeping up any fertilizer that gets on your sidewalks and driveways and making sure it goes back on the yard.
You are pro dandelion, aren't you? We have this idea that we should have a monoculture in our yards. And, you know, we should be right on, you know, we should have grass and nothing else. Right, Paul? I mean, it's like we're afraid to have weeds in our lawn.
Right. But, I mean, fertilizer and all, if it's done properly, it's not bad.
Okay.
Our issue is that people over-fertilize. It spreads out onto the driveways and sidewalks. And now with that state law Caroline mentioned, it has to be swept up. You can't fertilize between, I think it's December 1st and April 1st. So these are all things that the state realizes that if people went along with those issues, they would cut down on the amount of runoff that's going on. So
you've got a chart in front of you that says fertilizing your lawn the right way.
Right.
The do not and the do's.
Right.
And so, you know, Caroline hit some of it, but what else would you add there?
And this is off of New York State's phosphorus law. As I mentioned, you can apply fertilizer only during
April to December.
Right, April to December, right. And then, as I mentioned, about sweeping it up. But also, if you live on near a water body, you can't fertilize within 20 feet of a water body. So a lot of people don't realize that as well. So they're not fertilizing right down to the edge because then it just goes right into the water. So that's kind of what the state law now requires, and that's what we're promoting. It helps us promote our fertilizing.
One of the ways you can know, Evan, is when you pick out your fertilizer, they have those three numbers on them that indicate the different components, and the middle number should always be a zero. That's the phosphorus that it contains. And the only time you can use phosphorus-containing fertilizer is when you're starting a new lawn, or you do a soil test and it says there's not enough phosphorus. But as Paul and Caroline said, the soil in this area really doesn't typically need phosphorus. So always go for the zero phosphorus containing, which means the middle number on your fertilizer should be a zero.
Has this effort moved the market? Are there fewer products with phosphorus on shelves because of it?
I think there's more products on the shelf without it.
Okay.
That's a requirement that they have to have a specially labeled area in the store that says phosphorus-free fertilizer. Right. So it's easier for consumers to locate that.
Okay.
If we're done with the phosphorus, I want to move on with a couple other things.
Absolutely.
The whole program started with five things that people can do around their homes. We want behavioral change. We just talked about the lawn care. There's a pet waste needs to be picked up. Oil and other automotive fluids need to be discharged properly or disposed of properly. There's household hazardous waste needs to be disposed of properly. And washing your car. You mentioned that earlier. We like to see it done on a lawn or take it to a car wash. Keeps those keeps the pollutants out of the stormwater, not out of the storm drains.
Okay, and so those are some shorthand ideas for what we all can do. And listeners, if you've got questions on water pollution, what causes it, maybe some of the things you're doing at home, and you're questioning that, it's a great chance to get some answers. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, your perspective on this campaign and what you want the audience to take away from this today.
We've had a great deal of early success at the Rochester Museum and Science Center on the first two of three phases of work with green infrastructure, which is a phrase we use for the design elements of really any space, but in particular urban environments, there are specific things that you can do, and they're demonstrated on the campus of the RMSC, starting with the parking lots that are paved with special porous asphalt to capture and return the rainwater to the aquifer, as opposed to running it into the storm systems and overwhelming them. There's a beautiful education pavilion that has a suspended rain garden populated with native flora that are adapted to survive in different conditions, and it's just a spectacular overall demonstration of the design techniques and technologies that you can do in your own home and model and replicate. And at the same time, we're conducting active research on this. We have interns that are actually studying the runoff water through a series of sensors called hobo sensors below the surface, and studying this and sharing this data in a broader context. And then inside, we've developed a series of exhibition experiences for young learners to come and see what this technology looks like and what it can do and improve the quality of water in their future. We're really proud of this important work.
on Dan's list there was porous pavement. And one of the things I think about is driveways, for example. Are we using the right materials to construct driveways? Can that change? Are we more aware of what's out there? I can somebody help me with that?
Sure. Porous pavement is generally not used for individual driveways,
okay,
just because it is a fairly new technology, and there's you generally want to use large batches of it for large, like, commercial parking lots. It's not economically feasible for a small driveway at this point. However, one of the other things that we recommend for homeowners to do to help preserve their water is to use a rain barrel or to plant a rain garden, which is basically saving the water from your rooftop, storing it in a rain barrel, and then using it to water your plants. Or a rain garden, which basically is used to absorb all the water that comes off your roof.
Again, how do you define a rain garden?
A rain garden is an area that captures roof runoff from your rooftop that comes down your gutters. If you disconnect your downspouts that takes that water and feed it to a garden area, then that water can be absorbed by the plants, and it'll prevent that water from going into the storm drain where it's getting polluted. And it also, when it goes into the storm drain, contributes to flooding.
Pretty easy DIY kind of project?
Yes, it is. And one of the things that we wanted to mention today was that the Water Education Collaborative does a series of public rain barrel workshops and rain garden workshops. If people are interested in learning how to do a rain garden workshop in the spring, we do these workshops around the community through parks and recs departments, libraries. We're going to be doing some through Eco Park, and the Rochester Museum and Science Center has been a great partner for us doing these workshops. And we have more information about those workshops on our H2O Hero Facebook page.
Todd, you mentioned that in the 10 years of the H2O Hero program, things have evolved somewhat. I know you've done surveys in different years, and the data is interesting on that. But before we talk about that, why don't we talk about the mission, what H2O Hero actually is, mm-hmm. and how that has evolved a bit.
So the goal really for the H2O Hero initiative is to get area residents, to inspire area residents to embrace their responsibility to protect and improve the streams, lakes, and ponds near them, leading to a greater impact as well. One of the challenges, and this is actually a change that we've made in some of our strategy, from the very beginning, we were talking about the role that we all as consumers can have on improving Genesee River quality, Lake Ontario water quality, which is absolutely scientifically factual and accurate, but in many ways hard for people to believe, right? To say that what I do in my front yard in Gates is going to have an impact on the Genesee River strains credibility for a lot of people. And so while that is true, what we determined was that it wasn't a practical approach for us to take. So we've recently changed our approach to really talking about the water body nearest to you is something that you can have a much more immediate impact on. So if you live in a neighborhood that has a stream running through it, or you live in a neighborhood that has a retention pond for stormwater management, and you're sick of, by July, the fact that that pond looks like it could be walked across because of the depth of the algae that's growing there, there is an actual impact that you and 10 other houses could have on that pond looking like a much healthier body of water. The good news is that has a cumulative effect, because that water, when it outflows from that pond, goes into a stream or a creek that flows into the river, that flows into the lake, and has an impact on Lake Ontario water quality as well. But nobody wants to have that stinking algae pond in their neighborhood, or have a creek running through their backyard that has no crayfish, no frogs, no fish living in it. And there are things that we can do that have an immediate and very localized impact as well. So we've really changed our approach to our messaging to be more about that, and then also some really exciting projects that are going on in the community, in particular two projects, one in Brighton and one in Webster, that we're really excited about.
Can we talk about those in a moment here?
Yeah.
All right, before we get to those, let's grab Pat and Grease on the phone first. Go ahead, Pat. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Yes, feel about Monroe County Water Authority injecting 240 tons. That was 240 tons of hexafluorosilylic acid a year into our drinking water, when 99% of this contaminant ends up polluting our environment and our waterways.
Pat, stay there and make sure our listeners heard the question. What's the contaminant you're, or what's the, what is the name of it?
The chemical is hexafluorosilylic acid.
Okay, obviously that's not in my wheelhouse. Anybody here want to Anyone familiar?
It's a chemical that's put into the water to add fluoride, but again, 99% of this material ends up in the waterways, not in our bodies.
Okay.
And
Pat, I appreciate that. I don't know that that is within the scope of H2O Hero or...
Well, go ahead. It's 240 tons of a contaminant, and it does contaminate the water. I was just wondering how they felt about it, if they've considered it or not.
Let me just ask you just a little bit on how you seem certain that it's contaminating the water, and I do not want to question your strength of conviction on that. I just want to know how you are aware that it's contaminating the water.
The source of this chemical, it's considered a waste, and they can't put it into the water where it's produced. So the EPA has decided that it's okay to distribute it to the 50 states and pollute all our local environment and our local water.
But I don't think the EPA would say it's okay to pollute, right?
They say that because it's diluted, dilution is the solution to pollution.
Dilution is the solution. Okay. Pat, thank you for the phone call. I don't know that our guests are immediately versed in how to talk on that one, and I appreciate that. We will try to look into that separately for you, Pat, because it's a good question. I don't know the answer offhand, and I don't want to speak out of school on that. But listeners, if you want to call the program with other questions or comments on water quality and what we are doing in our own spaces, in our own yards, in our own streets, when it comes to our behavior and how it's impacting water quality and what we can do. If you've got questions about what you're doing and if it ought to change, 844-295-TALK, that's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Todd, you mentioned projects, and I think Webster and Brighton.
Yeah. So there's a project, and I'm going to count on my colleagues on the panel here to talk more about this, but there's a project in Brighton that's been underway for quite a while around the Buckland Creek area. That's a great demonstration project. And then there's another one that is going on at Shipbuilders Creek near Webster Thomas High School. So I'd look to maybe
I'll
Paul to
be
take
glad
that.
To talk about that. Start off with Buckland Creek. A few years ago, a stream on Brighton High School, Buckland Creek, was rehabilitated, I guess I'd say, restored. They put in, they re-channelized. The stream bank was just was basically a drainage ditch, it looked like, but it was actually a creek. So they went and restored it, put in new plants and streamside plantings and all, and it looks really nice. But we took that opportunity to go into the community and do a public education campaign that says, you know, we need to restore Buckland Creek, and here's what you can do in order to improve situations. And we would point to the work that was done at the Brighton High School site. So we went out and ran rain barrel workshops and rain gardens workshops. We did streamside plantings and got a lot of folks on board over in Brighton and in the Buckland Creek watershed to participate. It worked out very well, and we're taking that same approach now with lessons learned, of course, and we're going to Shipbuilders Creek out in Webster. And we've just started a program, similar program out there. There are two public projects that people will be able to view. One is at Finn Park, where a retention pond is being put in, and the second is a section of Shipbuilders, tributary to Shipbuilders, on the Thomas High School site. So those are the two things that the public will be able to see, those basically green infrastructure put in place, practices put in place, and then we again are going to go out into the public, to the residents of Shipbuilders Creek, and talk to them about installing rain barrels, rain gardens, streamside plantings, and trying to increase their awareness of the whole H2O program and how they can improve and protect water quality.
You just said green infrastructure. Is that residential green infrastructure, community green infrastructure?
Right.
Is there a difference?
Good point. I like to distinguish. I call residential green infrastructure are downspout disconnections, rain barrels, rain gardens. Those are the primary ones that people can do around their homes. Then you get to the corporations and the municipalities and all, who can do the porous pavements, sidewalks, bioretention areas, all that kind of stuff. So there is a distinction between the two, but there certainly are those three primary things that people can do around their homes.
When it comes to rain barrels, how much water can that save a homeowner a year?
A rain barrel, first of all, in a typical rainfall, and a typical size house around here, maybe 500 or 600 gallons comes down. Our rain barrel's 50 gallons right now. You can tie more of them together. But so then with a number of rainfalls over the year, I think it's 34,000 gallons or something can be saved.
All right, so...
Is that right?
Caroline, yes?
Yeah, so by disconnecting your downspout, as Paul mentioned, an average roof produces about 500 gallons of water per half-inch rainfall. And over the course of a year, that is about 34,000 gallons of water. So there's a huge potential when you think about your own actions at your own home for disconnecting those downspouts, how much water you yourself can save.
And when you're filling up there, where are you moving it? I mean, these are such basic questions, but for the guy at the table who's never done this, how are you going to use it?
So what you would do is you would fill up your rain barrel, yep. And then there's going to be an overflow, which is going to route that water into a lawn area, and then the water will soak into the lawn. Now, there's a couple things that you want to make sure before you disconnect your downspouts, and if you go to our H2O Hero page, we recently... put a lot of information on our website, how to disconnect a downspout. There's some things you want to consider before doing that, how to put in a rain barrel, where to get a rain barrel, how to put in a rain garden. So you can go to our H2O Hero website, and you can click on the different tabs and find out everything you want to know about doing those and how to do those at home.
I would just add, Evan, that certainly you can save this much water. I think rare is the situation where somebody's going to have 10 rain barrels lined up to save those 500 gallons of water that are coming off the roof. And that's certainly saving water is a good thing. It really, in terms of impact that you have, reducing the runoff is the most valuable impact of having that rain barrel connected, as opposed to the downspout going straight into the storm sewer, or even running down your driveway. Because, you know, if your car is dripping just a little bit of oil and the stormwater comes out that downspout onto your driveway and runs down into the storm drain, it's picking up everything along the way with it and carrying it directly into the nearest waterway.
When you talk about dripping oil, we've talked a little bit about fluids, automotive fluids that might end up on driveways. What's the best way to keep clean and sort of be vigilant about that?
Making sure that your vehicle is properly maintained. If it is leaking any fluids, to get it repaired immediately. Using cat litter or something in your driveway to absorb any spilled chemicals.
Okay.
Also, if you change your own oil, make sure that you take that oil to a local gas station where they're required to take it by law and recycle it, as opposed to dumping it down the storm drain.
Which, unfortunately, people have done. It's been known to happen. I want to talk a little bit about some terminology here, and then I'll get a couple listener questions that have come in via Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Evan Dawson, or you can email the program connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. If you've got questions or comments about water, rainwater, water pollution, runoff, et cetera, what you ought to be doing at home, what you can be doing better, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In our second half hour, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other data from the 2015 survey, which I think is the most recent. Is that right, Todd?
That's correct.
But one of them that stands out is about 50% of respondents know the definition of a watershed. And that means about half don't. And it's funny. I said, I know, of course I know what a watershed is. And I think, I don't know if I had to define it. Like if I was sitting in a classroom and it was a test and I had to write a definition, I don't know if I would get an A answer for that. So watershed, what's the definition?
A watershed is an area of land that drains to a particular water body. So wherever you're standing, anywhere on the planet, you're standing in a watershed. Here where we are, in the city of Rochester, we are in the Lake Ontario watershed. And of course, there's sub-watersheds that make up those larger watersheds. So if you live, let's say, in Brighton on Buckland Creek, that water will go eventually into Lake Ontario, but our sub-watershed is Buckland Creek. And of course, all those activities that go on land are going to affect the water quality of the watershed that you live in.
Okay, I would not have gotten an A. I might have gotten an okay score, not an A. John on Twitter wants to know, how bad is asphalt driveway sealant for the environment? Is it necessary? Roads aren't sealed. Why driveways?
I know that driveway sealer, it's probably not good for the environment. I think it tends to still leach out over years, and so that's a problem. On the other hand, being practical, you have a big investment in a driveway, and people have to protect them. And we can't, I'm not going to stay here and or sit here and say that they can let that investment go away in order to protect the water quality. I would like to see them, however, do them when needed. Maybe it's not an annual event that needs to be done. So there may be other ways to, you may be able to prolong it a little bit, maybe other every other year to minimize things.
I think one of the things I think is interesting, and this applies to fertilizing as well, that we have to recognize that a lawn that looks like a golf course and a driveway that looks like it's been freshly paved every year has an environmental cost. And we have to, there's a cost benefit analysis that we have to do all the time. And if you're fertilizing, you're doing a 3 or 4 step program on your lawn and your lawn looks like a golf course, there is an environmental cost to that activity. Similar to the, as Paul said, the driveway. Maybe it doesn't need to, maybe our standards, we should be open about our standards in terms of how perfect and how much of a monoculture our lawn needs to look like.
And one alternative to driveways are porous pavers. Having your driveway be created with porous pavers, which are basically bricks with spaces in between where the water can soak in. And those are available at a lot of local lawn areas.
You remember the old driveways that had the bricks with the grass growing in between them, or mm-hmm. the driveways that just had the two rows? Those are great for green infrastructure.
When you think about a lawn or a golf course, think about the species that were displaced and the other forms of life that could be there. But instead you have one species of grass or maybe a few that look nice, but in reality are not really that diverse. Back in the 70s, was it Jonathan Shell, Fate of the Earth, where he said today's golf course is tomorrow's desert, because in many cases that shotgun form of technology is so rough on the environment. But often the land cannot be easily recovered, if at all.
I think about our lawns and just what is sort of socially acceptable. And I think, you know, to Todd's point, if your lawn looks like a golf course, there is a cost. And I would love to hear from listeners on this. Are you tolerant of your neighbors occasionally having some dandelion fields there? Is that all right with you? Is there a bit of a kind of an expectation? Is it gauche to have a multiculture there? Or should we get to that point? That doesn't mean never mow it or never maintain it. But what does it mean for you and where you live and your thoughts about that? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Next, we have Roy in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Roy.
Hi. So my question was concerning the rain barrels and the runoff in general from residential areas. How much of our, you know, I don't know what the correct terms are, but, you know, we obviously have all the runoff eventually ends up in the probably Lake Ontario, right? And what what sort of percentage of that flow of water, like, is there any consideration for, like, if enough people did this rain barrel thing, would it change how our waterways flowed? Would there be any concern about that?
No, it wouldn't affect our watershed at all. However, in areas like Seattle, they've done green infrastructure programs on a wide scale where they're actually the government was actually supplementing people and helping them to put in rain barrels and rain gardens, and doing that on a mass scale, they actually significantly reduced the amount of runoff and pollution going into their local waterways.
Okay,
it's really impressive.
Reducing the runoff there actually just is an overall positive effect then?
Absolutely. Also reduces flooding too. As you get more development, you get more of these hard surfaces called impervious surfaces, sidewalks, rooftops, runways, driveways, and that water, then when it rains, rather than that water soaking into the lawn or the forest or the natural landscape, it's hard surfaces and it's running off. So you get an increase in the amount of water going into the waterways with development, which of course contributes to flooding.
Okay, cool. Are there any negative side effects at all to widespread decrease in runoff, even minor ones?
I think the answer is no to that.
Yeah.
I think you look at a place like, one of the things that I heard Caroline talking about the other day was about the impact of some of the major flooding events that have happened recently in areas where there's been huge increases in building in recent years. And you think about when we build out areas and expand, we build huge parking lots, we build buildings with roofs, we build driveways and all these impermeable surfaces that direct the water as fast as possible to stormwater systems, which can get overwhelmed in rain events that are much smaller than what they saw in places like Houston. And really, green infrastructure can be seen as a source of resiliency for a community, environmental resiliency, so that when we do have major rain events, that that we don't end up having the kind of flooding that can end up being devastating.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. Appreciate the phone call. Susan in Shortsville, we're going to come to you next. We're going to read more of your emails and questions that have come in. Amanda's got a question about lawn treatment and a lot more here. And Todd Butler, where can people go online to learn more about the H2O Hero program?
Well, it's easy to remember. H2OHero.org is the website, and we're also easy to find on Facebook, and we do a lot of communicating about the issues and about where you can get engaged and how on through social media.
All right, H2OHero.org, and our panelists are all talking about these issues in terms of having clean and good water in our own communities and maybe thinking about ways we all can make an impact there. Let's get that break, and we'll come right back to more of your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. It's been a heavy week in the news. We're going to try to lighten it up a little bit. Now, we lost Tom Petty this week, but we are going to take a look back at his life and legacy. We'll listen to some of his music, and we'll talk about, even though this was a man acclaimed for his rootsiness, he performed in sold-out arenas. So what is his musical legacy? We'll explore it. Then in the second hour, the Teacher of the Year from the New York Board of Regents is from Brockport. We'll meet Christopher Albrecht. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get back to the phone calls. This is Susan in Shortsville next. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to comment that I have not only dandelions, but I leave milkweed growing. And my question is, how long do I leave the milkweed there? Do I have to leave it through the winter to help the butterflies?
Hmm.
Does your panel have any idea? Because I can't seem to find that out online.
It's a good question.
I would imagine the seeds left in the milkweed are good food for birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
And it'll help you have more milkweed.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure my neighbors just love me, but I love watching the butterflies landing on the milkweed. So.
Well, good luck to you, Susan. I wish we had more for you than that. But we're starting to see a good number of comments about lawns. I want to hit this because the H2O Hero program has done a number of surveys over the years, and it's been interesting to see over the last decade or so what people say about, you know, lawn care, keeping a lawn, fertilizing a lawn. So let me read a few comments first. First of all, one listener writes to the program and says, the lawn is an unnecessary concept. It was originally a form of status in England. Lawns were created for golf and bowling. I don't know exactly the history of the lawn in the United States. I think there's a book. Listeners, remind me what book I want to read on this, because I think recently this came up. And I would love to learn more about how we had these monoculture grass lawns in our country. But I appreciate that. And then Amanda writes to the program, and she was asking about specific companies that do lawn treatments, fertilizing treatments. I'm not going to mention any company names, but I'm going to ask her question more generally. Because, again, I don't want to malign any companies that are trying to do good work for people in their homes, but we are concerned about what fertilizing might mean. And Amanda asks, are there any companies that do multiple lawn treatments a year that get the thumbs up from your panel? So anything stand out, or maybe a better question is, how do you address this with your lawn care company? You know, Todd, you were saying, you know, ask them direct questions about what they use.
Yeah, I would ask, you know, ask questions. Tell them that this is a concern that you have. Tell them that you don't have the expectation that there'll be nothing but one species of grass in your lawn, and ask them, you know, how they can, what is the minimum amount of chemicals that are required in order to accomplish your particular goals with your lawn, and make sure that they don't take a more generalist approach. That might exceed what you'd actually want to have happening in your lawn.
And with regard to fertilizer, they could ask, how much phosphorus is used on the lawns, and is it an option to go phosphorus free?
And I'll add on that, as I said, they should be sweeping their stuff up. So if there's granules on the driveways and on the sidewalks, those should be picked up and put back on the lawn or disposed of. So they have to make sure that those companies are taking care of those things.
That's the law.
Right.
Most of the time when I see a company that is putting a treatment down now, they seem to go to the borders, the perimeters, and kind of face inward when they're applying, I think, just to make sure that they're not going outside the borders. And maybe, again, they're doing that because the law says they have to. But let me also ask, before we get into the survey, Dan was saying during our brief break here, you know, when you think about green infrastructure, you think about how we expect to have a lawn or grass or a monoculture. You were saying, you know, you'd like to see some of the kind of the culture change that says, you know, kind of embracing these some of these ideas. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to see the design aesthetic change. I'd like to see for people to come and see what this green infrastructure looks like. It's actually less clinical than it sounds. Some of these species are handsome and easier to maintain than a lawn. And I think young people have this particular power because once they know what this looks and feels like, they can say, hey, Mom, let's try this. We're big fans of project-based learning at the museum. It's a great project for a family to look at their space and say, how can we make it work better for the environment?
Okay. And Caroline?
And then just one thing I wanted to add is if you're interested in learning more about the green infrastructure, the Rochester Museum and Science Center has this great demonstration showcase of green infrastructure around their campus. They have rain barrels, rain gardens. They have a green roof, a new education pavilion, and exhibits devoted intentionally just to water quality, stormwater, and what green infrastructure is and things that people can do. So the museum is a great place to learn all about this.
I'd like youth to take this on the way they did in the, you know, with the environmental movement. When I taught middle school science for 25 years in New York City, and when once young kids adopt a cause, they become so passionate about it. You know, so many teenagers will say, hey, Mom, Dad, why are you throwing that away? You should recycle. And so I think that the youth voice would be very important in this conversation moving forward. I'd love to see that developed.
Why I love what the Museum and Science Center is doing there, because I can't tell you how many adults and policymakers and former members of Congress have told us they only got serious about climate change when their kids told them, we're worried about this, get on board. So exactly what Dan is saying, you know, maybe that extends to this arena here as well. Let me grab John in Rochester, who also has a fertilizer question. Go ahead, John.
Hey, everybody. A couple years ago, I bought one of the four-step programs, and I got too busy to do it, so now I have a lot of expired fertilizer. What's the best way to get rid of it other than putting it in the garbage?
You can take that fertilizer to Eco Park, Monroe County's Eco Park. You get on the Monroe County's website, and you can sign up. I have to reserve a spot to bring that in, I believe. But anyway, that's where you can get rid of it.
It's monroecounty.gov. Yep.
MonroeCounty.gov, and again, reserve a spot.
Right. You have to reserve make a reservation and bring it in. Yep.
But a really good idea to do that,
and
really thoughtful question asked, because certainly, John, thank you for that. You're not the only one who has something probably sitting in the garage or basement or somewhere in a shed that is probably expired and probably needs to be disposed of, not just in the garbage. Before I go to Dennis in Pittsford, who has a question in a different direction, Todd Butler, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what surveys say about whether we are fertilizing more or less these days?
So we've been doing a series of studies, and we add some questions and take away some questions over time, but that goes all the way back to 2000, and even some of it that goes back further than that. So about every two or three years, we'll reissue this survey and ask a number of questions, and in 2009, we started asking the question whether people use fertilizer and maintaining their lawn. And in 2009, about 44% of respondents said that they did use fertilizer in maintaining their lawn. And by 2015, that was all the way down to 29%. And this is a professionally conducted market research study that's projectable to the whole population. So the fact that we're seeing, you know, 44% down to 29% means that there is a movement that's underway, and way more people are not putting fertilizer on their lawns than are putting fertilizer on their lawns, which I think is great news for the environment, and also maybe gives, if you're thinking about doing this, gives you a little bit more comfort that probably your neighbors are skipping the fertilizer as well.
Or maybe would do it if you did.
Right.
There's
right.
a lot of pressure on streets. I also love the feeling of getting a dandelion root out by the root, just that feeling of really the deep root pull, and it's just, yeah, it's great. But I've also been told that there are more natural ways to kill dandelions. I don't know if it was white vinegar or mm-hmm. things like that. Is that right, Caroline?
Yes, I've heard that, yeah, using vinegar, spot treatments on those areas can actually reduce your dandelions.
All right, if you can't fully embrace them, there might be more natural ways to do it. Let me grab Dennis in Pittsford next on the phone. Go ahead, Dennis.
Hello. I have a question about the effect of road salt on the environment. There was an article in Science magazine, which is, you know, a science journal, in 1971, and it was about the effect of de-icing salt on the Irondequoit Bay. And the watershed around Irondequoit Bay at that time, something like 2 or 3% of all the road salt used in the country was going into Irondequoit Bay. And as a result, the turnover, you know, the inversion of the bay was delayed by more than a month in the spring and summer, and some years didn't happen. So I guess what I'm wondering about is, what is the status of road salt now, and what's being done to minimize that effect on the environment, which affects really all of the watershed?
That's a great question. I work with the Stormwater Coalition of Monroe County, which is comprised of 29 of the local municipalities in Monroe County. And one of the things that we're working with them on is reducing the use of road salt on our roadways. There's also an issue of safety, of course, that goes with that, where they say they have to apply a certain base amount of salt to protect the roads and protect safety. However, there are new types of equipment, salt spreaders out there, that can more definely reduce the amount of salt being applied to an area, and they're trying to be more aware of that.
That answer your question, Dennis?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, a great question. And listeners, we've got about 10 minutes left as we continue our discussion on our own impacts on our watersheds. 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. H2Ohero.org is the website. And Todd, what else do you want to add there?
So one of the things that I think can be a side effect of conversations around water quality is giving a misperception about the level of water quality that we have in this community. So it can always be better. It should be better. But Genesee River, if you look at the Genesee River in most places, it looks brown. And that's really a function of geology more than it is a function of pollution. You may have heard, Evan, about the one cubic foot promotion that the zoo did two years ago, I think, maybe. Where an international expert came in and documented all the biodiversity contained in one cubic foot along the shore of the Genesee River right in the city of Rochester. And it documented an incredible array of biodiversity in the Genesee River. The reason it looks brown, the bottom is a soft bottom as opposed to a hard bottom, which some of the bluer looking rivers have in them. And there is agriculture upstream. So those two things combine to provide us with a river that looks brown most of the time, but is still full of life, including things like sturgeon that are being reintroduced into the Genesee River very successfully and repopulating the river and Lake Ontario. And similarly, Lake Ontario, most of the experience that I have had most of my life, and that I think most people have had most of their lives, has been near shore in Charlotte, at Durand Beach maybe, in Irondequoit. But you get out 100 yards off the shore, or you get further to the east or further to the west, even near to shore. And I was paddling near Beechwood State Park over towards SOTUS a couple of weeks ago, and I was maybe 30 or 40 yards offshore, and I was in 8 feet of water, and I could count the stones on the bottom in Lake Ontario. And I think we often think that the lake is dirty, that the river is dirty, and certainly there's improvement that can be made, but we all should really appreciate this resource that we have and use it more.
And maybe not take it for granted, continue to do what we can to not pollute or not add to problematic runoff. But let me also ask, you know, Todd said at the outset here, we do have a hand in this in our own spaces, in our own yards, at our own homes, in our own driveways. And it's not just, you know, sort of big industrial when it comes to what's polluting water. But we looked at what happened in the spring and thought, well, that does feel out of our hands. You know, all of the wet weather we had in the spring, and we saw lake levels rise. And I don't need to revisit all the controversy, but I do want to ask how that's impacted quality and whether, our panelists have concerns about that going forward. Caroline, what do you think?
Well, I think it just supports green infrastructure in general. And we've used the word green infrastructure a lot. What is actually green infrastructure? It's an approach to managing stormwater that protects and restores the natural water cycle by soaking the water back into the ground the way it naturally did before you built these hard surfaces. So by soaking it into the ground, you're reducing the amount of runoff and you're reducing the amount of flooding that you're getting. So this actually, green infrastructure helps to reduce flooding.
Okay. Thoughts there? Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just thinking that, I mean, the flooding was a terrible thing down there, and a lot of the, I mean, I could see there was basically somewhat of a setback, I think, because, you know, you're washing over people's yards and all kinds of stuff. You're overflowing septic systems and sewer systems and everything else. So definitely, you know, it's beyond the scope of this whole thing here, but now that the water's receded, people have to get back on board. They've almost got to double down now on their GI and their water quality protection because they got to make up for all that, all the insult that happened during the flooding.
All right, let me grab Lois and Victor next on the phone. Go ahead, Lois.
Yes, hi. I was curious about pervious pavers. There was a comment earlier that the pervious concrete is cost prohibitive for individual driveways, but I was wondering, you know, what the panel's thoughts are on pervious pavers as an alternative for driveways and hardscape.
I could comment on that. Pervious pavers are actually quite attractive. A lot of the local garden centers offer them, and they're a lot of professionals that do installation, and it's also a do-it-yourself project. So I would encourage people to either look online because there's all different styles and colors that you can use, and they really can be quite beautiful.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, Lois, thank you very much for that phone call. Dan writes to the program and says, I'm curious if the panel has come across the book, and maybe this is the book I was thinking of, American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn by Ted Steinberg. Yes, Dan?
Yes.
You're familiar?
Yes.
Dan writes and says, he outlines how lawn culture was consciously produced by land developers, governments, and private companies such as Scotts. So how do we end up with the lawns and the, sort of this culture of front and the backyard, that kind of a thing? I think American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn, has some ideas there. So first of all, to Dan, the emailer, thank you for reminding me what I was thinking of. He also wants to ask the panel this. He says, you know, I know we've been talking about what we can do personally, and it's not just big industry, but he does want to ask if a major contributor to these runoff issues are agricultural operations, especially conventional and glyphosate-inclusive ones. What are the panelists' thoughts there?
So agriculture, you know, is a contributing factor to water quality. However, there are a lot of federal and local programs out there that work with agriculture. The local soil and water conservation districts, the federal government through the Natural Resource Conservation Service has a lot of programs that they work with farmers to help them prevent pollution coming off their farms.
Keep your eye on the innovation sector, too. There's some fascinating work coming with vertical farming. They're looking really at the compromise between producing enough healthy food but doing it in a way that's sustainable. So I think last week's Bloomberg Weekly had a fascinating article on these new large-scale vertical farm complexes. The science behind them is absolutely fascinating. Check it out.
Hmm. Back to the phones. Connie in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Connie.
Hey, good morning, or afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I lived in Brighton and took a swath of my almost front yard, side yard. It was probably 40 by 20 feet and just didn't mow it. And people would come by and sort of say, so what's with that? And I'd say, well, that's my little meadow. And I kept it neatly mowed on the outside, so the inside looked kind of contained, and it grew all kinds of cool stuff, and we had butterflies, and we had toads in there, and it was really a really simple way to sort of create a little environment without offending the neighbors. And so I just sort of thought I'd share that suggestion.
If I come to your neighborhood, they're going to say they're cool with this?
Yeah, they were. They were.
Good.
People did ask about
Good.
It. Like, how come you don't mow that? And I say, oh, I'm making a little meadow.
Well,
and kind of started a conversation on the sidewalk, and it was a lot of fun.
Very good, Connie. Thank you for that. Thanks for sharing your experience. It just shows that sometimes we assume our neighbors would not be okay with this. I'm going to read, before we lose the hour, Linda's email. She says, by the way, Evan, vinegar only kills the top of the plant. Dandelions do more good for the soil than turf grass, which has short roots, while dandelions fiberize and aerate the soil and feed the soil microbiology further down. So I appreciate that. She also mentions Dr. Doug Tallamy, an entomologist who's written and talked on the connection between the plants we grow, the insects they host, and the birds and other animals they feed. And he advocates turning our lawns into a positive force for sustainability by growing native plants. His book is Bringing Nature Home. That's from Linda. So, okay, some great resources from our audience and a lot of different thoughts. And we're down to about our last 90 seconds or so. So if you just joined us here, we've been talking about the H2O Hero community program here that's coming up on 10 years, right, Todd Butler, 10?
That's right. It's our 10-year anniversary of launching the campaign. I have to give a thank you to a company in town called Sigma Marketing that donated the creation of the H2O Hero campaign and was a huge force for this being able to be successful. And our local media has run literally millions of dollars worth of ads for us, getting this word out to the community about the role that we all can play in having a better water quality in our community.
And I agree with Dan. Get your kids involved, but also get involved yourself here. Paul, some final thoughts from you.
Yeah, this weekend is River Romance. We do an awful lot of outreach, and we're sponsoring tables at the Eco Fair, which Greentopia has Saturday afternoon right here in High Falls.
Let me go ahead and read this for you. I was going to read this before the hour's out, but okay. Paul and I are on the same page. River Romance Weekend is this weekend. It celebrates the history of the Genesee River. One of the events on Saturday is organized by Genesee River Watch, which, like the H2O Hero Program, is an organization that aims to improve the water quality of the Genesee River and its tributaries. So Saturday, they're hosting the Genesee River Bash from 5:30 to 10 at the Port of Rochester Terminal Building. They'll have music, food, activities, and more. Jump online, GenesseeRiverWatch.org, and you can learn more about River Romance Weekend at cityofrochester.gov/riverromance.
You scooped me.
How'd we do? We're on the same page. So much to think about there. And one more time, the website's, Todd, to find them online, your program?
H2Ohero.org.
H2Ohero.org. I want to thank all of our guests for being here and answering a lot of great questions from our listeners, a lot of common questions, and hopefully gave you some ideas for what you can do, what we all can do. So thanks to all of you for being here. Had a great afternoon. Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And have a nice afternoon. We'll be back with you on Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.